Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, August 18th, welcome to the show. I am Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman. Arendt, I thought you were going to throw in a fourth welcome.
I almost did.
Because we were off last week.
I know.
And it's sort of a special Monday.
It is, because we haven't been here.
We have not been here.
And I kind of miss saying welcome.
Only kind of.
I'm
logging that.
I did.
All right. So today on the show, we're doing kind of a roundtable concept. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about a lot of the big stories in the news with a pair of political reporters. We'll talk about what's happening with Ukraine and Russia. We will talk about what's happening in Washington, D.C. with the federal takeover there. And whatever else comes across the desk today. Mm-hmm. Studio 2 at WHYY.org is where you go to send in your thoughts. You can call 888-477-9499. We are asking today, what stories are you paying most attention to? What are the most consequential news stories out of Washington for people here in our region? Again, 888-477-9499.
And what's so interesting is, you know, we went on vacation. We both were off last week and the news headlines did not stop. And it actually like pierced through my little vacation bubble. And I'm like, oh, my goodness, things are happening. And so I'm so glad we're doing this roundtable.
Yeah, the world doesn't take a break.
It doesn't take a break just because, you know, so I hope people do call in. We'd love to hear what you think and what you're thinking about when it comes to national news stories. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org.
Why do they call it a round table, by the way?
Well, our table is more triangular.
Yeah, our table isn't round at all. Why is it called a round table?
I guess because there's usually a table that is round.
Is it really? I don't think so.
And then people kind of go around and share
their
thoughts.
That's true. They go around.
Yeah. They
our table, by the way, if you look in like the upper right corner of your laptop and you see that little symbol that tells you how strong your Wi-Fi is, that's the shape of our table. It's like a rounded triangle.
Yeah, it is. It is. I love our table, though, by the way. You know, I got to throw that out
great
there.
Table.
So we're going to get to our trio of news stories, and we're going to start with Pennsylvania politics. Republican Stacey Garrity has officially announced her bid to challenge incumbent Josh Shapiro for Pennsylvania governor. And Republicans, they think that Garrity could be a formidable opponent to Shapiro. She is currently state treasurer. She's a retired Army colonel, and she earned the highest number of votes ever for a statewide row office candidate. So she's done that. And she's also been aligning herself with President Donald Trump. And in a video she posted on social media, she says she's running to make the Commonwealth more affordable and more attractive to younger folks. She's also takes direct swipes at Governor Josh Shapiro, saying while he's been focused on running for president, she plans to focus on fixing Pennsylvania's problems. She takes jabs at the lack of a state budget, as well as some of Shapiro's liberal donors. Take a listen to some of what she had to say.
To know just how much of a failure Josh Shapiro has been, all you need to do is look at the facts. U.S. News and World Report now ranks Pennsylvania near the very bottom on our economy, education in our classrooms, and our state's infrastructure.
Whoa, so she clearly is baiting Shapiro into a fight and trying to use his ambition against him. But Shapiro will be a tough guy to beat.
Yeah, tons of name recognition, pretty good approval ratings. But part of what makes Garrity a strong potential candidate is the same thing that made Shapiro a good candidate when he ran for governor. Think about Shapiro's arc. He won his first state race in 2016, despite a Republican carrying the state in the presidential election. Garrity did that same thing in 2020. She won her first statewide race despite Biden beating Trump in Pennsylvania this year. Those are hard things to do, and they suggest some popularity that goes beyond just party affiliation. And so the big question left is whether she will be seriously challenged in the Republican primary. Doug Mastriano, who ran last time as a Republican, is lurking and suggesting he may get into the race, and he would be a formidable challenger for Garrity as she tries to get to the stage of facing Shapiro.
Yeah, and so we have some time, and we'll see. And plus, people, you know, they're kind of mad at the president right now, so we'll see if she'll be sort of have to deal with the headwinds of the midterms as
Could
well.
Could be a tough climate, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So staying in Pennsylvania now, as Harrisburg continues to haggle over SEPTA funding, the battle between southeastern Pennsylvania and the rest of the state, Cherry, has gone from under the surface, always there, to open hostility in a way I don't think I've ever seen. So here's the latest. In a rare case of a bill proposal going viral, a Chester County Democrat, Melissa Schusterman, says she will introduce a plan that would make it so southeastern Pennsylvania keeps the tax revenue it generates. Now, this bill has almost no chance of passing, but it underscores a big part of the tension here, which is that southeastern Pennsylvania generates far more tax revenue than it gets back in government aid from Harrisburg. And politicians in our region are pissed that public transit funding is being withheld given the economic importance of this region. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Joe Pittman, a Republican from rural western Pennsylvania, made a stunningly blunt speech on the Senate floor last week when he asked why his caucus should send money to southeastern Pennsylvania, given the response that he says he gets when he asks for support for his region.
What did I get? Crickets? Some nice words? No walk of the walk? And a lot of canceled meetings. And now you come to me. And now you come to me.
Wow. That's the type of thing you hear about happening in back rooms, not usually on the Senate floor. So that is how tense this situation has
gotten.
And
let me tell you, this speech pierced my vacation bubble.
Again.
And I went online, I saw it online, and I immediately went to the comments and I saw responses that use words like spiteful, asinine, egotistical, because like you said, so many constituents, they hear about these kind of battles, but they don't actually hear their politicians or elected officials say it on the record in this way. And, you know, a lot of folks that, you know, that were in my feed were all from the collar counties and Philadelphia. And they were like really, really upset. And they were like, look, we'll keep our money. But there's a lot of context and all kinds of stuff that you need to talk about there. But people feel some kind of way that, you know, you have elected officials who are thinking about their egos and their positions and not serving Pennsylvania.
The context, I think, is important, right?
Because yeah,
I think there's maybe a misconception that all the tax money goes to Harrisburg and then they choose to send it to red-leaning rural districts. And for the most part, that's really not true. What it really is a proxy for is poverty. So regions that have higher percentage of low-income people generate less tax revenue and then get more back in public assistance because
they are Medicaid.
They qualify for that assistance. And so, you know, it's not necessarily discretionary spending that's being like funneled this way and that way that causes this big imbalance. That said, if you cut off southeastern Pennsylvania and created a new state called Hogovania or whatever.
Hogovania, I love it.
You know, Philadelphistan, whatever you want to go with. The rest of the state financially would be in a lot of trouble, right?
They'd be broke.
Yeah, they would basically be broke. I mean, they would have to either cut services or raise taxes, maybe even both, right? So there is a legitimate gripe buried under all of this, which is that, you know, the Philadelphia region's economic engine is really important for the state budgetarily. Mm-hmm. And SEPTA is a big part of why that engine runs.
Yeah, and people want their SEPTA, man. A lot of comments online. That's a big story. They care about it. And so everyone's watching that. Our third story of the day. Well, New Jersey lawmakers, we're going back over to the Garden State. New Jersey lawmakers, they're going after reservation poachers in the Garden State. Now, apparently, there is this low-down, dirty world where third-party websites lock down reservations to the most exclusive restaurants, hotels, and bars. And then, get this, they sell them online to the highest bidder. Shout out to NJ.com for this fascinating story, by the way. The sellers, they go scoop up the reservations on OpenTable or Resy. They do this for free. And then they sell them for anywhere from $145 to more than $200 on sites like Appointment Trader. Mind you, the restaurants get $0 for the sale. The money goes from the seller to the bidder, and the website, of course, takes the fee. And these New Jersey senators on both sides of the aisle said they want to stop it. They've stopped it in other states like New York and in Illinois, and they want to have that happen in New Jersey. Your thoughts?
Well, can
Bobby
I play
Wolfman, Aaron?
Devil's advocate here?
Go right ahead.
Here's my question.
Mm-hmm.
Who is being harmed by this practice?
I would and the restaurants don't like this. Number one, they don't get paid for it. Number two, a lot of people are hogging the reservations, and they hold them sometimes to the very end, and they could have empty seats. And it could also mess up the goodwill to the restaurants.
I understand the goodwill part. But the empty seats, that's going to take care of itself. Because if the poachers are scooping up the reservations and then no one's paying for them, they're going to stop doing it, right? Wouldn't that just take care of itself over time?
I guess it would. But then there is money that's being lost by the restaurants in the interim.
So charge a reservation cancellation fee. That seems like the easier way to do this than having the government try to, like, whack-a-mole go after these people.
But still, the reservation fee may not necessarily make up for the amount you would make on a full dinner table. I'm just saying.
But if the reservations are going unfilled, they're just going to stop doing it. There's no incentive for them to buy them up and then not be able to sell them.
And by the way, Appointment Trader and other sites like this, they say people are not abusing it, that they're simply, you know, selling reservations that they're not using. But the problem is, it's just so sleazy to me.
I understand.
It's sleazy. Can you at least say it's sleazy?
Yes, it's sleazy. It feels bad. It does feel like a problem that polices
itself.
And
would you pay for a reservation?
That's the easy. I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
So if they do it, I will go to another restaurant. If someone else wants to pay that surcharge to go to a fancy restaurant, I mean, at the end of the day, we're talking about people going to very expensive restaurants. I don't know if the government really needs to protect these people or spend their time going after people who are making a little profit off of someone who can afford a $700 dinner.
Making profit, and the
that's
restaurant
my devil's
gets
advocate
zero.
Argument. Yes,
the
it's
restaurant
sleazy.
Gets zero for it. This.
Well, then the restaurants can do it.
Yeah,
charge $50 for a reservation.
Mm. Well, we have a lot to talk about on the other
I
side
don't
of this
know.
Break. National
it feels
story
like it takes care
up.
Of itself. I just feel like, why does the government need to be involved here? Welcome back. I am so happy you've made a lunch reservation to be with us here at Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg, and I'm so glad you didn't have to pay for it. So to today's topic, Congress may be in its August recess, but the national news cycle has not taken a break. Today, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and European leaders meet with President Trump to discuss a possible ceasefire or peace treaty in the besieged country.
Also today, Texas Democrats return to their state, clearing the way for Republican politicians to redraw the state's congressional lines. But first, we will start in Washington, D.C., where federal agents and National Guard troops are on the streets as part of a Trump administration takeover.
Could other major American cities be next? Perhaps Philadelphia. Here to discuss that and all the major headlines circulating as we start the week, we have a pair of political reporters. We have Shrey Poppett, a politics reporter for The Guardian U.S. Shrey, welcome to Studio 2.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We also have Bracton Booker, a national political correspondent for Politico. Bracton, nice to have you.
And our question for you listening, what stories are you paying most attention to right now in the national news cycle? What are the most consequential stories coming out of Washington for people in our region? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, drop a comment in the chat.
And so, Bracton, we wanted to start with you and in D.C. I mean, Trump has evoked the D.C. Home Rule Act, giving feds a limited time emergency lever to direct the Metro Police Department. Can you tell us what's happening in D.C. right now and what has been the reaction?
It's after Trump's Liberation Day announcement from the Brady briefing room last week, we have seen an uptick in federal troops, federal agents on the streets of D.C. They're patrolling national monuments. They're patrolling high traffic areas like Union Station, the Capitol, some of the federal monuments. And they're helping to, you know, what Trump was talking about, trying to help reduce the uptick in crime, which even though D.C. Officials argue till their faces are blue that crime has actually fallen since the high point in 2023. Trump has taken, some say, political ambitions to paint the District of Columbia as crime infested, being overrun by young thugs, underage thugs that are committing heinous crimes. So what you're seeing is just an escalation of folks in military garb, DC National Guard, and pretty soon you're going to see guards, troops from other states, the states of Ohio, West Virginia, South Carolina, have all pledged to send their National Guard troops to D.C. And what we're going to see is when they arrive, it's going to be actually a doubling of troops in the District of Columbia.
Wow.
And Bracton, what's the sense of what these troops are actually doing? You mentioned patrolling high-profile areas. Is that essentially it at this point? Is there a sense that they will become more enmeshed in everyday police work?
Not clear. I mean, certainly the Muriel Bowser, the DC mayor, is trying to exert what power she has left to say, like, look, I'm in control of Metropolitan Police. We are going to be the lead in enforcing, you know, traffic stops and enforcing the laws of the district. But there are rising questions about whether or not the incoming troops or future troops that are going to be in D.C. are actually going to be armed. The initial kind of wave of troops in D.C. are not armed, and they're supposed to be in an assistance role with Metropolitan Police. But if we're going to start seeing armed guards, that certainly ratcheted up the threat that there could be some kind of an exchange, and people are really worried that clashes may happen because of the broader, you know, spectacle of having folks with long guns patrolling their neighborhoods.
Yeah, and Shrey, you know, just if you zoom out a little bit, what has sort of been the political response to the fact that the president has executed this and is bringing in federal troops?
Yeah, it's been a real mixture. Obviously, Republicans, by and large, defending what the president's actions have been, saying that this is necessary because not only is DC, as Bracton said, crime infested, but also that the statistics that DC has put out are fake. These are baseless claims. The Justice Department issued a report earlier this year saying that violent crime in the district is at a 30-year low for 2024. And the crime in general is dropping across the district year upon year. But the president and much of his base has stoked claims that these statistics are phony, that DC officials have manufactured these claims. There have been attempts within the police department to manufacture these claims too. Democrats, on the other hand, have taken quite quickly to say that this is ultimately distraction. Claiming that there is a violent crime increase in DC is both false, but also a distraction from the president's handling of the Epstein files, the One Big Beautiful Bill, and the effects of that, and also the looming impact of tariffs. I was chatting earlier with Andrew Bates, former Biden spokesperson and now a Democratic strategist, who is saying that this rhetoric that Democrats have sort of latched onto, where they're saying that this is a quote-unquote distraction, is one that sits well with voters. It kind of acknowledges voters' integrity, their intelligence, that they get a sense that we understand what is actually going on, and that this federal takeover is actually something that is a complete distraction from the issues at hand for voters. And it's one that plays well to Democrats. I think also the idea that this crime crackdown, as the president's been referring to, is part of a wider midterm strategy as we kind of get into 2026, talking about how blue cities in particular are victims of increasing crime rates, and they are subject to the whims of their Democratic governors who've let this crime escalate, is, I think, part of a wider strategy that we're going to see across the board from Republicans.
Yeah, speaking of that, Bracton, Trump has suggested that other large cities may be next. legally, it's a totally different question because these are not federal jurisdictions. These are states, and states have sovereign authority on some level. But what has Trump said about what he may do next? And what do you see as the strategy behind those statements?
Well, I think it's pretty clear. Like the states he, I mean, the cities that he named in his big press conference last week included Oakland, Los Angeles, New York, Chicago. All these cities are major cities in states that he did not win. They're also run by Black mayors and have large Black and brown folks on the city council. And I think politically what he's trying to do is show that, you know, as a Republican president and someone who controls fully his party, it's Republicans that can bring law and order. The message that he ran on in 2024, it's him that can help establish law and order in some of these cities that have run amok, essentially, is what he is trying to do. Obviously, the lawmakers, both locally and statewide, have pushed back vehemently against this. Also, I left out Baltimore. I'm sitting in Maryland now. I can't live out in Baltimore. I'm up the street. And you have some of these governors pushing back. Certainly, J.B. Pritzker, like, brushed off this idea, the fact that he could even do this, citing, you know, constitutional authority, where you cannot send federal troops to do domestic law enforcement. And the mayor the governor of Maryland also said, look, I am the commander in chief of Maryland. I will not send any Guards troops anywhere under duress if I feel like this is not mission critical. Obviously, Gavin Newsom has been a big kind of thorn in the side of Trump. And what do all three of these men have in common? They're all kind of laying the groundwork for a 2028 run. So you can expect more rhetoric from them, certainly establishing that they control their own states. But as before that happens, and you see this kind of push and pull between these kind of juggernauts of the parties here, it leaves local officials kind of like on edge of whether or not they're going to have to be the ones that have to deal with the influx of federal troops. You look at Los Angeles earlier this year, when there were ICE raids, there were protests there, and both the mayor of Los Angeles, Karen Bass, and also Governor Newsom said, look, we don't need to deploy the National Guard. We are fine. We can take care of it. Trump essentially ignored that call and federalized the California National Guard and sent them to Los Angeles. So you can see, like, if this happens in other cities, that Trump may find some authority to use in order to deploy Guards troops and put them in cities, and again escalating this tension between, you know, the federal government and state and local government.
Yeah, I want to just remind our listeners that you can participate. We want to know, what stories are you paying the most attention to, and what are the most consequential news stories out of Washington for people in our region? Our number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, drop those comments in the live chat. We have an email from Matt, who says, I keep hearing that crime is down in D.C., but nobody says how the stats compare with other major U.S. cities. It could well be down, but is it from huge to acceptable or huge to still bad? The POV I find missing is that of the average people who live in the district. What do they think? Do they feel safer? Are they tired of crime or find the levels acceptable? Thank you, Matt, for that email. I want to talk about local official responses, because we've heard from some of our local officials, and I want to play a clip from Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner, who had a moment where he talked about the possibility of federal troops coming to Philadelphia. Take a listen to what he had to say.
I just never thought that military invasion of America's big cities with a fear-based racist agenda in order to pave a path for a military takeover is something that I would face.
And so I want to ask you this question, and Shrey, maybe you can weigh in on this, and Bracton, feel free to do that as well. You know, what should local officials be doing? Because, you know, you saw, you know, in L.A., you know, both the mayor, the governor were against, you know, federal troops coming in. You see in D.C., the mayor was trying to sort of be kind and work with the president on this, but had to take a stronger stance. What should local officials be doing as they ready for this possible, you know, you know, takeover. I don't want to say the word takeover, but sort of power grab by federal government.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting as well is that, and you pointed out about Mayor Bowser's response last week, I think it's been one that has had to sort of be a day-by-day response because it's evolved so, so quickly. And initially we saw last Monday when this sort of all kicked off, Mayor Bowser taking a sort of compliance stance, as you mentioned, saying that she'd be working with the federal government, you know, happy to provide the services as Section 740 states of the Metropolitan Police Department, generally kind of remaining a little bit calm, very much in line with the way that she's approached Donald Trump in his second term in office, which is a far cry from the way she handled the president back in 2020, particularly during the BLM protests in the city. So I think she's had to be a lot more cordial, a lot more tactical in her response, and she's been doing that. I think what we saw as the week went on was a pushback to that. You know, she was on a Zoom call with organizers later on in the week and called the move from the president an authoritarian push. At the end of the week, she described it as unsettling and unprecedented. She's really kind of taken these small but concerted efforts to sort of push back. And then at the end of the week, we saw the DC Attorney General file a federal lawsuit to essentially say that the federal takeover of the Metropolitan PD was hostile, was something that extended beyond the reach of the Home Rule Act, particularly when the Attorney General last week installed the DEA Administrator Terry Cole as the head of police, basically, in DC. Ultimately, the administration, and uncharacteristically, I would say, walked back that decision pretty quickly when the federal judge threatened basically to issue an injunction. So I think that was kind of a bold move by DC, and one that Mayor Bowser kind of championed as well. But I think it kind of showed an act of defiance and a small victory essentially for the city pretty early on in how they were going to have to piecemeal their approach to the president's moves. And I think, as I said earlier, it's a day-by-day response, and one that has to be a tactical one as well.
I'll just pick up on that.
Go ahead, Bracken.
Picking up on that last point, I think a lot of jurisdictions are going to be looking at how Muriel Bowser handles this and taking cues from her. Obviously, the courts have been a big tool in Democrats trying to push back on what Trump has been doing in his second term, because he's been far more aggressive in how he's gone about implementing his agenda through force, through will, through the fact that he's kind of taking over all levels of government in ways that we have not seen in any modern American president. So the courts have been a major tool for Democrats to try to push back on some of that, you know, what you call a power grab. Mm-hmm. You know, other folks are not being as careful. They're definitely calling this a takeover, an occupation in some cases. But I think what we're going to see is more elected officials try to paint the picture that what Trump is doing is illegal and outside the bounds of any presidency, and try to, you know, basically bloody him up, so to speak, heading into the midterms to show, like, look, if this can happen in major cities where, you know, like New York, that has the largest police force of any in the nation, then he can come into any small town in America and do this too. Do you want that for your American president, or do you want him focusing on the larger, more global aspects that a president should be doing? And also, he ran on trying to repair the economy. Do you feel like you have more money in your pocket? I think Democrats are going to try to tie that back into some kitchen table issues to run on in 2026. We'll obviously get some early indications in some statewide races in like Virginia and New Jersey later this year. But I do think that's the way that the Democrats are going to try to push back on that. And it remains to be seen how forceful the president is going to be in other cities. But certainly folks are taking cues from D.C. at this point.
Sure. And let me bring in and out a caller. This is Sally from Philadelphia on the line. Sally, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, I love that you guys are talking about this, but what I would like to say is that I think that not only is President Trump sticking his toe in the fascist values pond, I think he has his whole legs in there. I mean, he's trying to centralize autocracy, and he's subordinating individual rights. He's forcibly suppressing his political oppositions. He's, you know, disregarding all traditional democratic values. I think it's deplorable.
Thank you for that comment, Sally. And let me ask you, Shrey, is there any pushback from Republicans? You know, generally, historically, the state's rights, the individual rights, the Liberty Party in that regard, anyone in the caucus saying anything other than go for it, President Trump?
Not really. I think the base is kind of doing what the base has been doing, from what we've seen over the last, since Donald Trump lost the election in 2020, and kind of since he's been in office, they've rallied around a lot of his moves, and what he say kind of goes, to be honest. And I think what we are seeing as well is this kind of feeding into a narrative about sort of big, you know, cities and blue cities, as Bracton mentioned, being sort of crime infested. I think it feeds quite nicely into an overall GOP talking point that these Democratic run cities are in fact, you know, cesspools for crime, even though the evidence points completely otherwise. And I think, you know, I mentioned earlier about this narrative that the statistics are false, the data is rigged, which is something that Republicans historically in recent history have run with when it's come to elections. You know, I think this is an extension of that same narrative, and something that we could see kind of evolve in its own right, which undermines the whole idea of data collection when it comes to crime in these cities.
And just because it's come up and people have asked, according to 2024 FBI statistics, District of Columbia has the 10th highest murder rate among major cities in the U.S. But to your point about focusing the efforts and the rhetoric on blue-controlled states, Bracton Booker, number 1, 2, and 3, Birmingham, St. Louis, and Memphis, all in Republican-controlled states. Baltimore is the only city that Trump has mentioned that is actually in the top 10 of the murder rates. Most of those cities in the top 10 are in Republican-controlled states. Let's bring in another caller now. Mm-hmm. This is Andrew on line 2, who I think is living in D.C. these days, maybe has some Philly roots. Hey, Andrew, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hey there. I just wanted to make a comment. I'm back in the area for this week, but spent all weekend in D.C. I'm a longtime resident there. I personally did not see any police presence in my neighborhood. Which I live on right off of 14th Street, which is a nightlife area. Was there with my brother. I think that the police are largely concentrated in very low crime areas like Georgetown and even near the National Mall, which already had a high police presence, you know, for many months, just as it is. And, you know, just optically, this is just something that is showing force without actually targeting the root causes of the supposed crime wave.
Yeah, thank you. That's Andrew, who's originally from Philly, who's been living in D.C. Thank you for those comments. I'm going to read a couple that we got from YouTube. Mary says, I don't know what the answer is, but this is not the D.C. that my siblings and I grew up in. We went everywhere. D.C. is not safe now. Akram says, Democrats saying crime is down comes across similar to their insistence that inflation is down during the 24 campaign. I know it's factual, but perception is reality. People don't feel safe.
And those two comments went nicely together,
yeah,
by the way.
They totally did, both from YouTube. Also, as we go out to our break, David asks, who is paying for the extra troops in D.C.? And I understand this is federal, Shrey, is correct? The federal government is paying for this.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, federal government is footing the bill for the extra troops that have come from West Virginia, South Carolina, and Ohio.
We will get into much more on the other side of this break, including the big meeting between Zelensky and Trump today in D.C. Keep those calls coming, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are discussing the latest developments out of Washington, D.C. with a panel of national political reporters. With us from our country's capital are Shrey Poppett, politics reporter for the Guardian U.S. We also have Bracton Booker, national political correspondent for Politico.
And our phone lines for you at home, on the road, or on lunch break are still open. What stories are you paying the most attention to? What are the most consequential news stories coming out of Washington for people in our region? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, hello, drop a comment in the chat. Wanted to pivot now to Ukraine-Russia. Volodymyr Zelensky is in D.C. today to meet with the president. European leaders are also here in the nation's capital. The million-dollar question, I think, Shrey, is what do they want to achieve and what are their chances of achieving it? Help us set the table.
Yeah, I think it's that is the question, really. And I think it's one that is a little bit more complicated since the events of Friday. We saw the president run into that meeting with Vladimir Putin with some of his best intentions, with harsh possible consequences for the president. President Putin, if he didn't agree to a ceasefire, there were going to be economically severe consequences. None of that materialized. Mm. No ceasefire was met, and we've essentially achieved very little materially on Friday. And now we have a meeting with both Zelensky and a group of very important European leaders to essentially see what they can get to the table. I think one thing that we're certainly going to be watching is any push from the president to get Zelensky to agree to ceding any territory, something that Zelensky has said categorically he does not want to do because it's going to be a springboard for Russia to launch further wars. Vladimir Putin has said categorically now that that is one part of his deal that he wants, a vital territory for Ukraine to cede. And the president has sort of prefaced a lot of that on social media this morning. On Truth Social, he was sort of saying that territory exchange is going to be something that needs to happen in order for a deal to be met. So I think that's going to be something that we're definitely watching. And also the security assurances for Ukraine going forward, something that the European leaders have certainly been adamant about, making sure that there are security promises for Ukraine, whether that's Article 5 or further assurances.
And I want to ask you, because, Shrey, I mean, you had all these European leaders sort of switch their schedules last minute to make sure that they could show up and be a part of this meeting. What do you think their presence will accomplish? And how do you think it'll change the dynamic from the last meeting that we all witnessed, some really standout moments between Ukrainian President Zelensky and President Donald Trump?
I think that was one that really was so shocking for the world to sort of witness, in the way that the administration arguably sort of piled on Volodymyr Zelensky. I think that was so kind of awe-inspiring for the world to watch. And I think now the backup, essentially, that Zelensky has with these European leaders is something that I don't think we should take lightly, but I also think is perhaps an opportunity for the president to make a scene or a spectacle in the way that he was able to do so effortlessly back in February. I think that's something that Zelensky is certainly hoping for, to have this sort of backup, and particularly with certain leaders like Keir Starmer, who the president has struck up a very, very strong alliance with, both in terms of trade, but also sort of national security discussions. And then other leaders like Giorgia Meloni, who has a very strong relationship with the president as well. So I think we're just seeing how those allies rallying around Zelensky are going to hopefully mitigate any sort of blow-ups, particularly when it comes around those key discussions about territory, ceding certain territory as well.
And just for our audience at home, Starmer and Meloni, the leaders of the UK and Italy, respectively. You write for a European audience, Shrey, so I'm just curious what you think sort of the average average European seems like too broad a term, but what sort of like what is the interest on the continent and in the UK in this particular conflict? Is there keen interest? Are folks really hoping for a particular resolution in the coming days? Or would they be fine with this conflict continuing if it meant sort of taking a hard line against Putin's aggression on the continent?
I think, I mean, certainly in the UK as well, there is a huge push to both make sure that this conflict ends as quickly and peacefully as possible, but also, as you sort of mentioned there, to make sure that there is a line in the sand against Vladimir Putin. I think you have so many of these countries, you know, NATO members, who are very concerned about, should this war be allowed to escalate or continue and therefore escalate, what this really means for the security of Europe more broadly, and what this lets Vladimir Putin do on the world stage. And I think one thing that is really interesting, as Sherry sort of mentioned, is, you know, this is a very quick rallying around Zelensky and a very quick decision to get all these leaders in a room at the White House to sort this out sensibly. And to do that really means that the stakes couldn't be higher at this point. And I think particularly after Friday's meeting, that, or the ceasefire that never was, the meeting that was never, that never was, the press conference that never was, that's just, it escalated the stakes even higher.
Yeah, I want to read this comment from our producers. World leaders, they began arriving at the White House at the beginning of our hour, and Zelensky tweeted a moment ago that that his, quote, main goal is a reliable and lasting peace for Ukraine and for the whole of Europe. And it is important that the momentum of all of our meetings lead to precisely this result, end quote. And so, Bracton, I want to bring you back into the conversation and talking about the politics of all of this. What are you sort of hearing from Washington on both sides of the aisle? What are people, you know, sort of reacting to what the president had intended in his meeting with President Putin, versus this meeting that is happening as we speak?
Like a lot of things in American politics, there's a clear split screen. If you're listening to Republicans, they are praising Trump for having that meeting with Putin and saying that, hey, it's a showcase of Trump leading on the world stage, issuing peace through strength and having this flyover when you get the Russian president to come to a U.S. military base and have a sit down with President Trump, even though, as we point out, like there was no hard and fast kind of agreement. There was just kind of signaling that Trump certainly shifted where the American posture had been leading up to that meeting, and now is kind of putting the onus on Ukraine to accept some of what a lot of what Putin wants as far as, you know, territory that both the Russian military has claimed and has not yet claimed in the Donbas region, and saying, like, look, if you want this war to end, you have to accept the fact that you are not getting that territory back. That is a tough pill to swallow for certainly a lot of Democrats who say that, look, this man has just given a photo op to Putin, elevated him when he had been ostracized on the world stage, and now this is making the peace deal so much harder to achieve, because you've now given Putin a lot more talking points, saying, like, I met alone with the president of the United States, where Zelensky has to bring all of Europe in order to get anything get anything towards a peace process here. So certainly there's not going to be much agreement on Democrats and Republicans on how they are viewing this, but certainly the one point I have to, like, bring up, because it's all about the politics, Donald Trump wants a Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He desperately wants a Nobel Peace Prize, and he's trying to get any kind of agreement between Russia and Ukraine so that he has a better chance of getting that peace prize, of having somebody nominate him. And you already hear Republicans drafting letters of nomination for President Trump to get this Nobel Peace Prize. I'm not sure we're there yet, but a lot of folks, even after Friday's meeting, were saying, like, look, the fact that Putin came to the United States is already grounds for a peace prize. And you had Hillary Clinton even saying, like, look, if this man can get a deal, a peace agreement, she is saying that she would nominate Trump for a Nobel Prize herself. So I think there's a lot of pressure at stake for some agreement to come out of this meeting in the White House today, so we can get closer to a nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize for Trump.
And certainly on the politics and the optics front, mm-hmm. Trump has always tried to present himself as this great deal maker. And it seems he sees this as an opportunity to flex those deal-making muscles. We shall see. Here's an email from Christopher. President Zelensky has the right to join NATO in order to prevent being taken over by other countries, in this case, Russia. Trump yelled at President Zelensky at the last White House meeting. I would imagine today's scenario will be a step and repeat of that humiliation. Imagine being called to a meeting halfway around the world just to be yelled at and humiliated. Do you think that's a likely outcome here, Shrey? Sort of that Zelensky walking into that trap again, or do you think he'll at the very least avoid that type of sort of public disagreement?
Yeah, I think I'm curious to see how the president, particularly in front of the press at that section of the meeting, will behave. I think February was a very good example of deciding to double down in public in front of the pool. We'll see how that goes. But I'm more optimistic about the level of civility between the two leaders. And I think, President Zelensky is keen to be there and keen to make sure that these discussions, as you said, are well-oiled and rapid, basically, to have some momentum, because it does feel like over the last 2 weeks, at least, there has been this sort of very slow burn. You know, we're doing calls, we're having this summit that didn't go anywhere. We are now having this meeting that we need to see move. So I think to get that going, I think we'll see hopefully a level of civility between the two. And I think it's important to not underestimate the presence of these world leaders. They're all due at 3 o'clock to have a wider meeting. I do think that is something to keep the momentum going. And I think hopefully a check in Volodymyr Zelensky's corner as well when it comes to hoping that some of those demands are met.
Yeah, we have people who've emailed in and commented. Comment from Matt, who says, in order, the concerns that he has, the big stories, Epstein file, gerrymandering, Ukraine, D.C. takeover. Denise says, I'm paying the most attention to the D.C. takeover and the gerrymandering. Pennsylvania has practiced some historically bad gerrymandering in the past. This could lead to some districts that are really, quote, creative in all the wrong ways. And so we only have a few minutes left in the show. So I got to ask you about the gerrymandering issue in Texas. Democratic lawmakers there had left the state for a couple of weeks. I understand now they're coming back and this new map could pass. I mean, the likelihood, Bracton, that this could pass and what could be the impact, as far as a ripple effect, if Texas is able to gerrymander 5 additional Republican seats?
Well, look, I think that's going to be the battle of heading into the midterms. I think without question, once the Texas legislature gobbles in for this second special session, that if all parties are there, Democrats are heading back now, that map will be approved in pretty short order. We can get that by week's end at the latest here. And certainly that starts the ripple effect of what we're going to see perhaps in California, as Gavin Newsom has announced that, look, he is willing to play the same kind of hardball tactics that Texas is playing, introducing his own map that would net 5 Democrat seats in deep blue California to kind of offset the 5 Republican seats that Texas is trying to pick up. But you also see some redistricting happening in Ohio that was already scheduled to take place this month. And they could net as much as 3 of three more Republican seats, putting more states like New York or Maryland in a position where they may have to come up with some creative redistricting themselves in order to offset those gains that could come in either Missouri or Ohio or some other states. So I think this is going to be the battle of the remainder of the year, and the ripple effects are, people are not going to trust who draws their lines. And this has probably already been happening, but it's going to be a renewed focus on whether or not folks actually believe their maps are true and fair. And it really just undermines our political system here.
Shrey, real quick, as we wrap up, just a minute left. Anything we haven't talked about we should be paying attention to, or you want to add something on the gerrymandering topic?
Yeah, just on the gerrymandering point, just great points there by Bracton as well. And I think, we're going to see, the California legislature is convening today, and they've got, just a few days now to get all these, this package of bills to basically get this map approved and the special election on the books, basically, in November done. So I think they're, as you said, moving at breakneck speed to get all of this done as well to offset those seats. And I think the arms race that this is sort of inspired across the country for these House seats really can't be underestimated. I think it's people are now going to be quibbling for those one or two extra seats they can get in those states. And I think it's also just shone a light on the impact both of mid-decade redistricting and also Democrats' response to that. You know, once upon a time, they would probably say that mid-decade districting was the rot as part of the way that gerrymandering is structured in our country. And now it's actually become a really powerful tactic for Democrats to show that they are fighting back. And, you know, we've seen over the last year or two, at least, complete frustration within the party that there isn't enough walking the walk. And that's certainly something that Gavin Newsom has tried to really commandeer, and I think is inspiring across other Democratic governors across the country to do as well.
Shifting that Overton window. Shrey Poppett, politics reporter for The Guardian US. Thanks so much for your time this hour.
Thank you.
Racton Booker, national political correspondent for Politico. Also, big thanks to you. And let me just read in a couple more comments. Sean says, free Gaza. Israel must stop weaponizing aid. Also, Trump is the worst. Tiffany says, I'm looking at the executive order to stop mail-in ballots, something we didn't get to today, but hopefully in a future show.
Yes. And thank you to everybody who called in, emailed in. Watch us on YouTube. Thanks a lot. And thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Besser, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, Al Banks and Tina Calique, engineer today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.